Please welcome Gina Whitaker.
My story tonight is Tender. It's a story of a young woman growing up and making mistakes and how it all came out in the end. It might not be that unusual a story, but it's the one I'm going to share tonight. The year is 1962. I'm a senior in high school, and my high school years have been miserable, filled with anger and disruption. I was a child of divorce, so I was shuttled between my parents' homes from age 13 and dealing with a couple of evil step-parents along the way, of course. I couldn't wait to graduate and move out. That was my full focus at that point. I made a plan, and I had a plan, and I was going to execute it no matter what my mother thought. Sometime during my senior year in high school, I got involved with an older guy. Larry was 20. And he was eccentric. He was barefoot. He was a kind of a West Coast beatnik type guy. And he was also a budding alcoholic. We used to hang out in the room that he lived in where he worked. He worked at a pet hospital and lived in a room there. And pretty much we'd get together, and I felt really grown up, smoking and drinking vodka screwdrivers with him. He would call a cab to pick me up. He didn't have a car, but he'd usually pass out drunk before the cab even got there. So this went on for a number of months, and suddenly, right around the time of the senior prom came along, Larry broke up with me. And I was pretty devastated. My mother, of course, hated him. He was the epitome of everything that she didn't like. And so 10 days after I turned 18, which was a couple of months after graduation, I moved out. I went to live in a rooming house in Santa Barbara, in town, and my mother couldn't understand why I want to move out and live in the same town where she has a free room for me, but I wanted to leave. So I went to live in the rooming house with seven other girls who went to City College. And we all started going to City College. And it wasn't very long before I was the brunt of all the teasing and taunts because I was still a virgin. Mind you, they might also have been, but that was not the deal. You know, they were going to make me the target. So I was pretty miserable there too. And then one night that fall, Larry called me. He said, "Let's get back together. Let's go to dinner." I was ecstatic, of course, because he was the one person with whom I wanted to lose my virginity. Why, I don't know. But I did go out with him, and during the 3 months of dating that we did, I realized I lost my virginity, I lost my self-respect, and I realized he was just a drunk and nothing was going to go anywhere. So this time I broke it off. I'd been a straight-A student in high school, and so at City College, you know, that work was pretty easy, but I was failing almost all my classes. Why? I was falling asleep in all my classes, and every morning I was waking up queasy and nauseous. It didn't take long to realize that I was pregnant. The move. I didn't really want to stay in Santa Barbara, so I moved to LA, and my best girlfriend from junior high said, "Come live with me. I'll stick by you the whole pregnancy. We'll get through this." So off I went to her apartment, kind of a sleazy place in, I don't know, some part of LA, Hollywood. And We lived, actually, it was on Normandy Place, I remember. They were like little cottage sort of things, like almost like a motel, but they weren't really a motel. And we lived in this little apartment, fought like cats and dogs. And then I got a job. I got a job at Bank of America, and the operations officer was sexually harassing all the women that worked there. You'd come into work, he'd swatch on the bottom. It was so blatant. It was so the 60s, so not now. But he didn't really bother me much because I started showing. And when I started showing, they fired me. Because in the 60s, it was legal to ask on an application, "Are you now pregnant?" And I had said no because I was desperate for the job. So they fired me for lying on the application. So I was about 7 months pregnant and had nowhere to go. Meanwhile, Margalot, who was going to stick with me, had fallen in love and was going to go live at 19 with this boyfriend and help him raise his two sons, who were 2 and 4. So I had nowhere to go. I couldn't really go back home. I couldn't see going back to Santa Barbara. So I don't really remember how, but I found my way to the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers. The Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers was a big two-story tan sort of institutionalized building in East Los Angeles. It was kind of a cross between a hospital, a prison, and a haunted house. That's what it felt like. The woman who ran it, Jean Nelson, Mrs. Nelson, she was a real do-gooder social worker type. She was a social worker. She ran this place. She had a welcoming smile, but behind the welcoming smile was judgment. You know, she knew best, and all of us girls were kind of stained, a little bit dirty, and she was going to fix us. So I went to Florence Crittenden Home, and I realized after just being there a very short time that there was a real kind of not-so-subtle message there, which was, you will give your baby up for adoption. They assigned an adoption worker to each girl when they arrived, and we would meet with her every week and get some counseling and talk about, you know, being pregnant and being a teenager and such. I was 19 at the time, so I was a little older than some of them. And there was also a psychiatrist there. He was really creepy. He was a paraplegic, so thus in a wheelchair, which right away made it strange. And then he was obsessed with Rorschach testing. And all he ever wanted to do was give us Rorschachs. And he wouldn't let us out of the room until we told him we saw sexual images in the Rorschachs. I'm telling you, it was quite a place. There was a psychiatrist, there was this judgment, there was this judgment feeling going on there all the time. And the only person there who really loved us unconditionally and was available for any hug, any time we wanted it, was Miss Hattie. Miss Hattie was a black cook straight up from Mississippi. She cooked us Southern food every day. Everything was basted in lard, and she would just be there for us if we wanted to talk or cry or whatever. So Miss Hattie was our friend. But getting back to this subtle, not so subtle message that you would give up your child for adoption was that if you did give your child up for adoption, you would get to come back to the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers for 1 week after delivery to recuperate and sort of figure out where you were going next. But if you didn't give your baby up, you couldn't come back. You just had to go wherever you were going to go, straight from the hospital. So I went to birthing classes. And there was an obstetrician that came. I forgot, I knew there was a third creep. And that obstetrician would give us prenatal care, but later I found out that he got arrested for molesting some of his patients in Hollywood in private practice. So he was really creepy too. So I went to birthing classes with couples, and that was kind of sad, and I felt really ashamed and lonely and sad, and I was there with all these couples that were looking forward to their baby's birth, and I knew I wasn't going to be taking a prize home after the birth, so it was sometime in that time that I decided I would give my child up for adoption because I was not ready to be a mother. I desperately wanted to go back to college. I wanted to get involved in politics. It was the 60s. I wanted to date again. And so I knew that. But I had some very specific requirements, and I set them out with the adoption worker. I said, I want the family to be educated. I want them to be college educated. I want them to be the same ethnic background as me and the father of the baby. And I wanted them to be Methodist. Because I knew I'd never find Unitarian Universalist parents, so I figured Methodist was good. So I went through the birthing classes. I don't have a really lot of memory about the birth. I had a lot of drugs. I had a spinal. They were really, you know, they just wanted to drug you in those days anyway. I don't remember too much about that. But the next morning after having this little girl, the nurse brought her to me. I didn't know if it was a mistake. I didn't know if maybe she wasn't supposed to because I wasn't going to be taking her home. But she did. And she brought a bottle, and she brought this little girl, and I held her, and I fed her the bottle, and I unwrapped her and checked out her fingers and toes and saw that she was really healthy and strong. And then I made a really, really, really big wish for her to have the best life she could ever possibly have, and I sealed that with a kiss and gave her back a few minutes. So there's two really short epilogues to this story. In 1973, 10 years later, I was pregnant and happily married with my first son. And I was looking for a job. And there was a job at the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers. So I said, well, I know that place. I'm going to go there and do this job. And it was stay overnight and supervise field trips and supervise the girls and then work for, you know, 48 hours and then get 3 days off or something like that. So I went there, but I didn't last more than a month or so. It was kind of a dangerous place to be pregnant. I saw my old room, my old bed, but the clientele was completely different. Good girls now had abortions, which was legal then in 73. So the clientele was all women of color, gang members, really hard girls, just street girls sometimes, and they all kept their babies. And they kept their babies there. And one night, someone actually tried to smother her baby. They were really messed up kids. So I didn't think it was a really good place to be working, and I left. The second epilogue is that in 2003, with the help of a person who does this sort of thing, I found my daughter. And I met her once. We had a long visit, and I found out that she had had the best life possible. She had wonderful, loving parents, loving siblings, and that was all I needed. And she thanked me for giving her life.